Hi, I'm Bob Crawford, and beginning this winter, I'll be hosting a new original podcast focused on the 2020 presidential election, The Politics of Truth. On The Politics of Truth, we'll get expert analysis from our nation's most reliable journalists, experienced pollsters, pundits, and historians. And because this is the Osiris Network, we're going to speak with musicians from your favorite bands and get their take on the intersection of music, politics, and activism. The Politics of Truth, first episode premieres February 7th. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Visit osirispod.com/politics to learn more. I'm Bob Crawford.
I'm Ben Sawyer.
And this is the Road to Now.
We both said it at the same time. Jinx. Yeah, jinx. Right. It's President's Day, everybody.
Yeah, you know, we were going to, let's just tell them. We have an interview that we did last month with Tim Mossberger that I know a lot of you guys know Tim out there. And it's on archiving because he is the archivist. He's the de facto archivist of the Avett Brothers.
Self-made man.
Self-made man. So we had that ready for today. You would be listening to that right now. But we've done this show for 4 years, going on 4 years, and we've never done a President's Day show. We've never done anything about presidents on President's Day. I don't remember us ever doing that.
We did. Didn't we do John Avalon, but we didn't do that at the same time. All I know, we've done ones on presidents, but look, when you said...
Not on President's Day.
Yeah. Bob texted me and said, another President's Day without a President's Day episode. He texted me on Friday. And so as you guys know, we're recording this just hours before it will come out on Monday morning. And out of the good graces of Gary Fletcher, who has agreed to edit it, it's going to happen. So here we go. My proposal was, Bob, why don't we each come to the table with our three big moments from American presidential history that we feel like are significant, and we don't know what the other ones is, so this is going to be fun. So I guess, Bob, we'll take turns going at it, huh?
Let's do it. That's great. Yeah.
All right. You want to go first? You want me to go first?
My first one, 1937, the Judicial Procedures Reform Bill of 1937.
Aha.
Ben, do you know the more recognizable name of that bill? What do people call it?
I don't know.
It's the court packing bill.
Oh, yeah. I knew that anything. Okay, yeah. This is in response to the moment which Franklin D. Roosevelt has his political ambitions checked a little bit.
Let me tell you how I came about this. Yesterday, I interviewed John Heilman for the Politics of Truth show that will, I believe it airs tomorrow or Tuesday. Okay. It's a show where we're following the 2020 campaign, but we're also looking at the intersection of music and politics. So when I was researching Heilman last week, he worked for Wired Magazine in the early 90s. And okay. This connects to one of my next one, right? When we go back and forth, three, it's my third actually.
Okay.
I came across something while I was researching him and his work in the 90s at Wired Magazine. So it got me thinking, these are three moments of presidential history, but they're not the most flattering moments to the president.
Yeah.
To which they are attached.
Yeah. You know what I feel like America needs less of right now? Like grandiose depictions of what presidents are.
And this is what we need. We need the executive branch maybe needs to fall back.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
As they say, maybe the executive branch needs to kind of get put in its place a little bit. And I have a feeling that if President Trump is not reelected and he leaves office, that the next president's not going to really have a lot of leeway. The legislative branch will take the opportunity to assume its a natural place in the checks and balances that the Constitution laid out so adeptly many years ago.
Yeah, good. I mean, this is what I've been saying to my Democratic friends. Can we keep this level of scrutiny up even if the person you want is in office? You know, can we establish a fair standard to where, I mean, one side's got to show good faith to the other, right? Right now, it's like everybody on the Republican side's like, oh, you know, you're saying this, but when your guy was in there, Democrats, if your guy wins this time, you have the chance to actually go out there and say, we are going to criticize this person as we did Trump. Let's keep on them. And if they whine about it, who cares? I mean, they took the job.
Well, think about it this way. If you have a President Bernie Sanders, of which half his own party, at least, is not in love with the guy.
Oh, yeah.
Or his policies, right?
Yeah.
So, or his, you know, proposed policies. So I imagine he would face a lot of scrutiny from both sides of the aisle. And if you have a President Michael Bloomberg, he was a Democrat, he was a Republican, he's a Democrat, you know, I imagine that he also would face a lot of scrutiny.
Bob, can I just say this? America, let's be honest. If our choice this fall comes down to a choice between Trump and Bloomberg, can we all just agree to propose a constitutional amendment that every 4 years we just see who's got the most money and whoever's got the most money is just the president from now on? Just save us the trouble. I mean, might as well, right?
Well, here's the thing I don't understand. I understand why people would not want to elect Bloomberg, but I don't understand how they can make the money argument of not electing Bloomberg, because Trump has raised more money than any presidential candidate in the history of the United States. Like he is sitting on a war chest that we have never seen in presidential politics before. So the only way a Democrat can win is with Bloomberg's money. So how can they complain that, hey, this guy's got all the money? Really? Really? If you can't, the Democratic Party has not been raising money. Trump, every time he does something stupid and gets criticized for it, he makes a t-shirt out of it and he makes $20 million. So, guys, it's fine to not want Bloomberg. That's fine. But you need the money. You need the money. It's got to come from somewhere.
Yeah, I think that it's just where it's coming from. But that's another issue. Let's go back to the court packing bill, because this is This is essential, because it is an example of a president's authority at a moment of unquestionable. I mean, after that 36th election, I mean, Franklin Roosevelt just dominates. And it is unquestionable he has the coalition. And the Supreme Court is in his way. It's a Supreme Court where you have several appointees by the 1920s presidents who are small government folks. The first part of the New Deal, a lot of the provisions get shot down by the Supreme Court. Roosevelt says, all right, well, I've got an idea. What we'll do is I'll just, you know, there'll be a mandatory retirement. So some of you guys have to retire soon.
Yes, he proposes that to appoint 6 new judges, one for every judge who is 70 years plus 6 months of age and has served for 10 years or more. That should fix it, he says.
Oh, yeah. Also, I love the objective use of standards. That's what I love. Just anybody that's in this category, you know, just might so happen to describe pretty much everybody who's against me.
Because older guys, they can't handle the caseload.
Oh, yeah. I love it.
They can't handle the caseload. Yeah.
Well, this is an interesting area, though, because the thing is that the Constitution doesn't say how many Supreme Court justices there will be. And by, like, some accounts, people that were debating it when they talked about, like, the judiciary thought it might be one person. And early on, it wasn't even a place. You didn't even have a building for them. I mean, nobody wanted to be on the Supreme Court because
it wasn't meant it the basement of the Capitol at one point?
Yeah, but they were just riding the circuit. They were just going from place to place to place to review laws. And so nobody wanted to do it. And they were like, it's gone up and down over time. But it's been set at 9 for a while. And so there's nothing unconstitutional. And this is where it gets, because it doesn't say anything, right? There's nothing unconstitutional about it. The issue would be it's unethical and it's an opportunistic move. And to say that you have all this power and backing behind you. And let's remind us, this is not a president who's bragging when he tops 50% in approval ratings. This is a guy who's revolutionized radio, a guy Roosevelt has absolutely changed the relationship with people. You can read letters that are written to FDR and see that. And even his own party, who all of them, it's an interesting thing, all of them individually might have been able to kind of knock each one of them down if they had, one or two of them had done it. But generally the party stands up against them and they check him. And that's probably good for us moving forward, if anyone's listening out there. it might be relevant to today.
Well, Ben, what was your first one?
All right, my first one is this is the one I'll talk the least about, probably. It's about the same time, actually, just a few years before that. I'm going to say it's appointing Francis Perkins, FDR appointing Francis Perkins as Secretary of Labor. I think when you look at what that does for, you've already got the Democratic Party has already taken on the mantle of the progressive era. They're already, the switch, which we'll talk about in a little bit here, where the Democrats have taken this on against the presidents of the 1930s, the Republican presidents who have essentially said do very little. Hoover does more than people give him credit for. And now you have the wind in the sails of the Democrats, unquestionable power, and having someone like Francis Perkins right there in the middle of it all, a very progressive person, a person who saw the Triangle Fire in 1911 when young women were throwing themselves out of the top of a 10-story building in New York because it caught on fire, because the doors were locked, because the people who managed the building didn't want the girls taking extra breaks. They're stealing extra cloth. That's what they accused them of. And so a city that doesn't have fire trucks that can reach up that high because they're not caught up, and workers who were treated like dirt, and that's a formative moment for her, for a lot of the reformers of that era, coming in, and Roosevelt knew that she could get things done. When the issue comes up, you know, of appointing a Secretary of Labor, he offers Perkins the position, and Perkins says, we're going to go for an 8-hour workday, right? And FDR is like, well, I don't know. And Perkins is basically like, all right, well, if we're not, then, you know, maybe somebody else would be better. And this is a woman who's being offered a presidential cabinet position. No woman's ever been in the president's cabinet at this time. And she's so strong in her convictions, she's not like, oh boy, I'll make history. She's like, nah, we're getting things done here. And she revolutionizes things. Social Security Act, 8-hour workday, the end of child labor. So many of those reforms, the weekend, right? I always tell my students, it's like, you think a weekend's a real thing? God himself got one day off. You think you deserve two? Like, okay, well, I do too. But that didn't just exist, right? So many of these great ideas and solutions that would have been seen as, radical, and some people still did, and some people today still do, but in terms of improving people's lives, in terms of creating the idea of retirement for the average working person, so much of that credit goes, we think about FDR doing it, and he does deserve credit in that sense, but so many of those were coming from Frances Perkins and her relationship there with him. I think that was a moment where you look back and you go, things would be way different if you had not had Perkins in that position. So there you go. That's my first one.
That was a great one, Ben.
Thank you.
My second one. Are you ready? Are you so excited?
I can't wait.
My second one is Gerald Ford pardoning Richard Nixon.
Oh.
September 8th, 1974.
Okay.
Had the pleasure of going to see Bob Woodward speak last year. And he told the story of waking up it was a Sunday, and he wakes up that morning, and Carl Bernstein calls him and says, the son of a bitch pardon the son of a bitch. And for years, Ford got a lot of crap for doing that. And it probably cost him the election against Jimmy Carter in 1976.
He almost got primaried in 76 by Reagan.
By Reagan, right. But years later, not too long before he passed away, Woodward got to spend a couple days with him and interviewed him. And he said, listen, it was the only thing I could do and the best thing I could do for the country. Because could you imagine a former president on trial? What that would do to us as a country? So really what Ford did was sacrifice his political future for the good of our country. And so, I think he needs to be recognized for that and appreciated. I know it's complicated. People want justice. I understand that. But Ford, he did the right thing. So that was my number two.
Yeah, and he, in a lot of ways, saved the Republican Party because he loses to Carter. And Reagan, who had already distanced himself from Ford and from Nixon already during the primary in 76, Ford's able to essentially take that down. He goes down with that ship, and then Reagan shows up, and he's like, this is a new party. And that might have been very different if they had continued, because these trials, it would have been quick. It would not have been quick, you know? And yeah. God knows what all Nixon did. We know enough. But yeah, I think a lot of people also looking back on it, the general crisis of confidence that was going on. It's like, you know, with the Senate investigations and finding out about the assassination attempts and so much that had been going on in the executive branch and so many of the limitations that go on there. It's like it was a time of like a lot of information, and maybe in some ways, I don't want to say this for sure, but maybe it's worth thinking about the fact that Nixon may have taken a lot of the brunt for that. Is it possible that Nixon could have taken more than he deserved? I don't know.
Probably not.
His cup runneth over.
No, but what it did was it overhauled the Justice Department. It led to overhaul the FBI, the Justice Department, the CIA. It inspired at least an era of transparency in that part of the government, and that area of transparency is now gone.
Another one of these horrible bipartisan moments where you're like, you know, it seems like we're so divided, but what party's president has done the most to undermine the issue of transparency? All of the above. It's rough.
All right, Ben, what's your second one? I can't wait. I'm so excited. I think it's going to be something positive.
Okay. You decide. My second one is when Teddy Roosevelt comes and runs in 1912, decides to back and run Bull Moose
the
Party.
The Bull Moose. Yes.
Yes. That is a critical moment where it's like, you know, he comes back and Roosevelt's personality is so big that I think most of the time you think about it in the light of like him coming back. And the background is that when Roosevelt ran in 1904, he hadn't been elected in 1900. He had taken over a couple months after he had jumped on the vice presidential ticket with McKinley. He was not his first vice president. So McKinley added him in 1900. McKinley wins. A couple months later, McKinley's assassinated. Suddenly, Roosevelt, who like 6 months before this had been like the police chief in New York City, a guy who like people liked but wasn't anywhere near what happened after he really BS'd a story about taking San Juan Hill in 1898, which, spoiler alert, was actually taken by the black regimen there. It just so happens that Teddy Roosevelt had a great reputation with the New York Times reporters, and they talked to him, and he told the story. And for a long time, people believed it. But go back and look into that. Even Pershing, who was there, the general, says it wasn't Roosevelt who made it. But anyway, Roosevelt then becomes the governor of New York, then vice presidential candidate. When he runs in 1904, it's the first time he actually has to run. And he says, I will not seek another term after this. And he passes off in 1908. He's like, I'm standing by my word.
And then before he knows it, he says, dope.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The dumbest words. Apparently, like, his family was like, what did he just do? Like, there's no way this guy actually wants to do that.
And William Howard Taft, who he was very close with, they were good friends.
Yes.
And Taft did not live up to Roosevelt's progressive hopes for the presidency.
Yeah.
And so Roosevelt, he's done being president. Taft wins election. He takes off for 6 months.
To prove to everybody, because people were like, it's almost like I think about the relationship between like Putin and Medvedev, where everyone's like, dude, you're okay. Like, you're not the president anymore, but like, you're going to be there. You're prime minister now. But like, you were like, hey, we're going to appoint this guy. He's like, he's totally cool. And then everyone wins and everyone knows he's pulling the strings. So like, that's obviously much later, but Roosevelt's like, I don't want you guys to think that I'm just putting a puppet in an office. So he just takes off and leaves the country and goes on a safari. And he's like, I'll show you guys what's up. And he comes back. And I think the problem with Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, is no one could be the president he wanted him to be, because there was only one person who was the president he wanted to be, and that was him. And that guy had not run again. So after 4 years of Taft, Roosevelt sitting there being angry, Roosevelt in 1912 decides to launch a third party bid to become the president. He leaves the Republican Party temporarily. He forms the Bull Moose Party. And in doing so, and this is why I think this is a pivotal event, Republicans had been the ones more on the side of using the federal government, right? Goes back to the Civil War with Lincoln, right? They had been more activists. By splitting the ticket in 1912, what he does is it allows Woodrow Wilson to win. In a long stretch of presidents, from McKinley all the way up until Franklin D. Roosevelt, there's only one president who's Democrat, right? I mean, you're talking 1897 to 1933. One president, it's Wilson. But at that moment, they ran Wilson because he was super progressive. And so Wilson ends up winning. He continues the idea of progressivism when he comes into office because that's what the country wanted. And in the 8 years that he's in office, the country turns against it. World War I turns people against it. And on the back end of Wilson's candidacy, by 1920, the Republicans now are running as the party of no government, small government, return to normalcy. And what ends up happening is that kind of that 1912, allowing Wilson to get into office, is that shifts the power in the parties. And it shifts actually like the agenda and the party platform of activist government from the Republican Party into the Democratic Party, which then follows through Franklin Roosevelt. So a lot of people ask, like, how does that shift happen, and particularly with the South going from solidly Democratic to solidly Republican? You can't understand that if you don't look at what happens with Wilson from the beginning to the end of his term. And you would never, almost never, you know, you can't say never, but like, it's highly unlikely you would have had Wilson as a president if Teddy Roosevelt hadn't come back and run, split the vote on Taft, and allowed for him to come in and become the president. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense.
Okay. So that's why I think 1912, that even though he loses, right, even though it's kind of, you know, it's made out to be like this guy and his ego, that nevertheless, that moment by former president changes the country and its politics.
Hey, this is Bob Crawford, and I'm here with Jamie Jeske. We're backstage at the fabulous Fox Theater in St. Louis, Missouri. Jamie, I'm so glad that you stopped by and brought some coffee today. I think RTN listeners would really be interested to hear a little bit more about the mission of La Cosecha Coffee.
Yeah, thanks, Bob, for the opportunity. Yeah, I do too, and I know that a lot of them support us already. But basically, when we started with La Cosecha, which is Spanish for the harvest, we got together, a couple of guys that we started this company with.
And your coffee, we'd call this fair trade.
That's right. So there's a model of fair trade, and then now there's also a direct trade where we work with importers who directly work with the farmers. And so it's just they get a higher price. Right now, coffee is the lowest price that it's been in like over a decade. And so they get a higher price than what is traded on the market.
Well, Jamie, we appreciate you and your mission, and the coffee is just wonderful. And thank you so much. It's great to work with you.
Thank you.
To try some of the delicious coffee that Jamie roasts and find out more about his business, check out La Cosecha Coffee Roasters at their website. That's LACOSECHA coffee.com. Enter promo code RTN10, that's RTN the number 10, and get 10% off your next order. Also, if you love the Road to Now, you can order a package that includes delicious La Cosecha coffee and a Road to Now mug, so you can get a great deal on two things at once.
I picked one that is actually helps to answer a question of how the country changed from one thing to another. I am drawing right now. I told you, interviewed John Heilman, did a lot of research about the beginning of Wired magazine and the beginning of the internet, you know, beyond ARPANET and all that stuff that we talked about with.
Yeah.
Brad Fiddler.
Bradley Fiddler, yeah.
Yeah. But talking about the early 90s.
Yeah.
Jill Lepore, who's a Harvard history professor, who wrote this incredible narrative history of the United States from Columbus to Trump in one book.
Wow.
One narrative.
That's impressive.
And every time a historian writes something, there could be criticisms of it. There should be criticisms of it. But one thing you can't criticize with Jill Lepore is her prose. She is she's the Seth Avitt of historians. I mean, like, she writes, she has a grasp of the English language that makes reading pleasurable. So Lepore argues that after 9/11, and the war on terror that followed, the United States found itself in a moral crisis. Post-World War II, United States helped to establish a world order a Western world order.
Right.
With organizations like NATO and the United Nations.
Right.
The World Bank. These were organizations that kept all nations accountable. After 9/11, in the war on terror, we faced this moral crisis. And, you know, the two, I guess, easiest examples of it are torture and wars of aggression. That the United States was now, we were now going against these like kind of rules and doctrines that we had established post-World War II. So Lepore says you can't understand that without understanding the rise of the internet in the 90s. Lepore writes of Wired magazine. Wired launched in March 1993, flaunted cyberculture's countercultural origins. Its early contributors like Stuart Brand and John Perry Barlow, a gold, necklace, and scarf-wearing bearded mystic who for many years wrote lyrics for the Grateful Dead. In Wired, the counterculture's dream of non-hierarchical, non-organizational world harmony found expression in a new digital utopianism. As if every internet cable were a string of love beads, Brand, writing in an article in Time, "We owe it all to the hippies," announced that the real legacy of the 60s generation is the computer revolution. Between the 1960s and the 1990s, the revolution had moved from the far left to the far right. Wired was edited by Lou Rossetto, a libertarian and former anarchist known to lament the influence of the mainstream media. In the magazine's inaugural issue, Rossetto predicted that the internet would bring about social changes so profound their only parallel is probably the discovery of fire. The internet would create a new world order, except it wouldn't be an order. It would be an open market, free of all government interference, a frontier, a Wild West. In 1990, Barlow had helped found the Electronic Frontier Foundation to promote the vision. In 1993, Wired announced that, quote, "life in cyberspace seems to be shaping up exactly like Thomas Jefferson would have wanted, founded on the primacy of individual liberty and a commitment to pluralism, diversity, and community," end quote. The Digital Utopians think tank was Newt Gingrich's Progress and Freedom Foundation. Established in 1993 and later the subject of an ethics inquiry, its key thinker was the irrepressible George Gilder, resurrected. Gingrich appeared on the cover of Wired in 1995, Gilder in 1996. Gingrich was battling in Congress for a new Telecommunications Act, the first major revision of the FCC founding 1934 Federal Communications Act, itself a revision of the 1927 Federal Radio Act. His objective was to ensure that, unlike radio or television, the new medium would lie beyond the realm of government regulation. Gingrich got his wish. On February 8, 1996, in an event broadcast live and over the internet, Bill Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act in the reading room of the Library of Congress. He signed on paper, and he also signed online at a computer terminal. If little noticed at the time, Clinton's approval of this startling piece of legislation would prove a lasting and terrible legacy of his presidency. It deregulated the communications industry, lifting virtually all of its New Deal anti-monopoly provisions, allowing for the subsequent consolidation of media companies, and prohibiting regulation of the internet with catastrophic consequences.
So what was the vote on that act in Congress?
It was largely bipartisan. There were only, I don't have the numbers, but there were only a few dissenting votes in either party.
So Clinton could, I mean, it was a veto-proof majority then, huh?
I can't say that at this time. I need to go back and do the research.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's, it is odd how you see all of that. And it's, I think I made, you know, I mentioned this in a previous episode, how interesting it is that when you look back at the founding, like how important the post office was, right? The post office and postal service was fundamental. I mean, it's like, it was a very big deal. And that's like a part of that's guaranteed, right? Congress has power over that, and that means a lot. And so if you don't think about like, okay, well, that's physical delivery. I mean, what it was control of information. And, you know, it's fundamental in the same way that like the press was. And so it's interesting that especially in the, by 1996, you start to see it's like emails becoming more and more important. It really is a hub of information. And certainly now looking back on it, like you can see how much more it's become. But the idea that it's like there should be no regulation over it has had some really interesting effects, like, you know, limited regulation on what data people can collect about you, or, you know, the net neutrality issue, like, you know, allowing,
or that you can say anything in a campaign ad on Facebook and Facebook's not going to take it down.
Facebook flagged an ad that I put up for my comedy game show because it said, hey, is it, the ad said, do you like, it said, like live comedy? Come to Perfect Timing. We've got improv, stand up and sketch all in one show. And Facebook threw it back at me and was like, this has been flagged because it's presumptive. You're presuming something about people. And I was like, because I said, like live comedy? Like, I got flagged for that. And eventually it got passed through. I think I just changed the wording around. But it was like remarkable to me that I could say something like that. Like live comedy? Question mark. Come to this show. And they were like, well, we don't want you being presumptive. It's like, in the meantime, it's like, but if you had some money, you had a lot more money than this, then go at it, man.
So just real quick here, Lepore says that the crisis of moral authority that began with the war on terror at the start of the 21st century cannot be understood outside of the rise of the internet, which is everything a rule-based order is not: lawless, unregulated, and unaccountable.
Unaccountable. That's true. It is amazing what people will say to each other when they don't have to look each other in the eyes.
Oh, yeah. People say all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yeah, I know. And it's just like you wouldn't say that to another human being if you had to look at them. Or sometimes if you were not just a bot that was programmed to do that.
Well, I like to say of Twitter, which I'm on, I say it's a dark anonymous sewer.
Yeah, you just got to ignore it, man. Yeah. I mean, like people tweet mean things at me sometimes. And then I just go,
Teh. Ben, I, Melanie and I were driving down 40 the other day while the kids were at school. We were going out running some errands. And the Mike Bloomberg bus, Bloomberg was in North Carolina. The Bloomberg bus drove by us. And I took a picture of it and I posted it. And some of the comments I received, I just posted, you know, I posted it. I was like, Mike's getting it done on I-40. Like, and someone wrote, I may have to find a new favorite band.
Look, you know what music I like? People that make the music for me are going to have never seen a Bloomberg bus before. So that rules out any band that lives in any state that's a Super Tuesday.
It's just crazy when it just provokes. I mean, people are like, ugh, and like making just like, you know, sounds, but like writing out sounds with exclamation points. It's just the fact that anything just easily provoke, it's easy to provoke people. And yeah. I wasn't even trying to, I was taking a, I mean, if it's Bernie bus, I would have taken a picture of that and posted it.
Yeah. I just think you know, standing on the outside of this, I think it's remarkable how much people don't realize what they're saying to you is shut up and dance, monkey, shut up and dance.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it is. It's like, hey, so you're entertaining. I don't want to hear anything else from out of you. All right. You serve one function to me. That is your entire role. And if you have any thoughts otherwise or any thoughts on anything, that's violating the contract. And to me, all that sounds like is like, we don't pay you to talk. We pay you to dance. And it's just, anyway, it's,
you know, and this kind of gets back to what I hope that the politics of truth thing becomes, the idea of musicians. Where's that line? You know, where's that line? Like music can unite everyone, but taking a stance on an issue, no matter what it is, it could be pediatric cancer, it could be the environment. But once you take a, say, no, I believe in this, because this affects me personally, I believe in this, you're automatically alienating somebody. So what, like, you know, an entertainer or a musician, they're people too. My vote counts as much as anybody else's. In fact, it counts exactly the same as anybody else's.
Yeah. I just think it's, I mean, certainly you're free. You're free to listen to whoever you want to. But I think if music that you enjoy, I think that if you are unable to say that another human being makes beautiful music and it makes me happy. But if that other human being in a totally unrelated sphere does not agree with me on something, that I'm going to will myself not to find joy in the music. Like, it's like a package deal. It's like, at what point? So I think, I remember Sam Harris saying something like, people should have different opinions, but the problem is if I know your opinion on one issue, I should not be able to predict your opinion on like 8 other totally unrelated issues. Like, think about that. Why, if I know your opinion on gun control, do I probably also know your opinion on abortion? And why do I know that if you're wearing a Kid Rock shirt, that you have these opinions over here, right?
Well, you know, it's the thing of, it becomes the music of the tribe, the tribal culture, right? Oh, this person doesn't believe the way the tribe believes, so therefore their music is excommunicated. They are excommunicated from this particular tribe because they don't believe what we believe. And so now we just can't listen to their music, because I'm sure there's a lot of Republicans who won't listen to Bruce Springsteen anymore.
Right. Then maybe this goes deep, but one of the things that I always think about, and I talk about it in, you know, my classes and any type of history, is like the need to segregate, like how essential that is to like controlling people, is like telling people don't even engage with those other folks. If you engage, like, they're horrible. All right. If you go over there, they're just going to do horrible things to you. And like, that's why, like in the South, they need to segregate, because if you're like, this is what they do, and then you see each other, you're like, that's not what we do. And the whole thing falls apart. And I wonder if it's like that tribalism is like, if you listen to like, look, if you're a Republican and you listen to that Democrat and they're saying things about how they love other people and they love their kids, it's going to be common ground for you. So let's not let you listen to music that would make you think of them as human. I'm always skeptical of that. So also, you guys can tweet at me. All right. I'm not in a band. Okay. Bob's not saying this stuff. I'm saying it. All right. You know what? If you tweet at me about what I said about music, I'll make an album. I'll sing on it and you'll wish you hadn't. All right.
So I just thought it was funny because I don't go out there too far. Yeah. Normally.
Yeah. Bob. Well, I think
I just took a picture of a bus. Mike's getting it done. I did tag the campaign.
What if when you told me that, I just quit the podcast? I was like, I can't even be here with you right now. I thought you were a different person, Bob Crawford. Suddenly, all your opinions about history and the love that you've shown for me over the years don't matter because of that picture. Hmm. Anyway. All right.
Okay, what's your third? Did you got one more?
I do have one more. This might be cliche, but I think the greatest, most significant moment in presidential history is Washington stepping down at the end of his second term. I think that's
absolutely. In fact, we have a cameo. People aren't going to be able to see this.
What?
But we have a cameo appearance.
Who? What? What's that? Oh, George Washington, the action figure.
Ben, you chose wisely in your third choice of great presidential moments.
I agree with you. I have to say that. Setting the precedent that no other person has ever fulfilled, which is being the person who literally does not want to be president, but has a sense of duty to the country so sincere that in spite of really not wanting to do it, throws himself into it. Could have stayed there longer. I mean, you know, it's like people are like, man, he could have, you know, some people wanted to make him a king. He could have been president forever. It's like, did you talk to him? Because like, he didn't want to do it in the first place. But it was that blessing of like having, I probably said this before on the podcast, I say it in all of my classes, the French Revolution ends in Napoleon, the Cuban Revolution ends in Fidel Castro, the Chinese Revolution ends in Mao Zedong. Give me a revolution of the past like 250 years that ended in the guy who was the central figure, the leader in the military struggle. Give me one that ends with that guy walking away and leaving the system to run without that person. I mean, it's such a good precedent. And so,
what is the Bible quote, beating swords into plows?
Swords into plowshares. Yeah. And he goes back home and, you know, we all have our flaws. And, you know, there are those with Washington. I'm not trying to make him into something he's not. I mean, you know, as Chernow pointed out in that great biography, you know, he never seemed to be able to grapple like why the enslaved people on his plantation weren't happy and wanted to run away. And he came around in the end. But I think in terms of a legacy, politically, but then also, you know, the manumission thing. But more than anything, it's just leaving office, doing it because of duty, and then writing this amazing farewell speech that we all just were like, that's beautiful, and we all forgot about. That's that, you know, the greatest president's the one who never wanted to be it. And we have a system now that will never likely produce a president like that again. Unless you win this year, Bob, in which case, surprise.
Yeah, I'm not going to win. I can't raise any money.
All right. And that's our episode. But Bob, we've got some live shows coming up that we're really excited about.
Yeah. April 18th at the Polk Theater in Nashville, Tennessee. It's a 4 p.m. start. We have Langhorne Slim and director, comedian, writer, great guy, Tom Shadyac as our guest.
Yes. Tom Shadyac, who directed and co-wrote Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, directed, I mean, name a movie in the 1990s you loved, Nutty Professor, any of those. He directed all of them and now has started some amazing charities. And so we're going to talk to him about the, you know, how comedy has influenced his life and his story, which is really amazing. And any time with Langhorne Slim is a great time. He's my neighbor. I see him frequently and it always makes me smile. So we got that. And then we got June 16th. We're going to be at the Minneapolis Comedy Festival in Minneapolis. Out there, I've been, you know, Bob, I've been to Minneapolis one time in my life, and I came there in 2010 to see you guys play just for a night. I just came in and saw you guys play at some festival, and you guys were playing the main stage, but like the second main stage. And it was a beautiful night, and I had a blast.
Was it
and
the Basilica?
So the next time?
Was it outside the Basilica?
Yes, it was.
Oh, I love that.
Yes, it was.
I love that. That was a great night, a great location. Minneapolis is a great city. I love it. So excited to be there.
And so I'm excited about coming up there and doing the live show. And so you guys can get tickets for those on our website, theroadsnow.com/live-events, or just go there and click on live events at the top of the page. And we hope to see you guys there. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Road to Now. The Road to Now is hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. This episode was edited by Gary Fletcher. Our social media manager is Austin Sawyer, and today's music is by Paul DeFiglia. If you have not gone and rated us on iTunes, please do so. We need you to do that so we can spread the word about this podcast. Everyone who has, we say thank you. Speaking of thanks, we'd like to say a special thanks to everyone on Patreon who helps make this podcast possible, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hawking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Fig White, Jeff LeCain, Peggy Donica, Susan Sharp, Joseph Mann, Matt Williams, and Mariah Wolford. If you'd like to join our community of patrons and get lots of extra content, just go to patreon.com/theroadtonow and pick a tier. For as little as $5 a month, you get access to episodes 1 through 75, some extras, bonus content, and it only gets better from there. For Bob Crawford, this is Ben Sawyer. Thanks for listening and take care.